Hello and welcome to Open Door Films. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Spotify for Podcasters. Spotify for Podcasters lets you create your own podcast and allows it to be distributed across multiple platforms. It's very easy. If you want to create your own podcast, all you got to do is just click on the Spotify for Podcasters link I've left down below, and within a matter of seconds of recording yourself and pressing that publishing button, your podcast will be distributed across all podcasting app platforms, whether we're talking Apple, Spotify, Lisbon, CurioCaster, Podfreeze, and even the second sponsor of this podcast, that being Fountain, a podcast listening app that allows you to earn Bitcoin while you listen to your favorite podcast. It pretty much works the same way Apple and Spotify work, but instead of having to just simply listen to a podcast, you're actually earning money while listening to your favorite podcasters out there. And you can even support them by sending them Satoshis, which are increments of Bitcoin. It's pretty much like as if you were to go to the movies, but instead of having to pay a ridiculous amount of money for a ticket, you're actually being paid to watch the movie you already love, which is a great fantasy to live out. But I guess Fountain will be the second closest thing to meet that fantasy. Anyway, in addition to that, I've left affiliate links down below. Hope you all enjoy them, just as much as you enjoy my conversation with David Libin. He's a writer, producer, director, as well as the chairman of CU Denver College of Arts and Media, and I realized I read that from his IMDb page, but that was just my attempt at being clever. Granted, I still enjoyed my conversation with David because we talk about his recent film, Publisher Parish, which is a dark comedy about a professor who is on the verge of getting tenure, but he ends up murdering his student. In an attempt to protect his career, he just makes one bad decision after another, hence having his whole life spiral out of control. I guess the best way of saying it is, because the film hasn't come out yet and I've only seen the trailer, and I'll leave a link down below, is that imagine if they, instead of creating a meth empire, Walter White from Breaking Bad was to murder a student. And if you watch the first episode of Breaking Bad, you can see a lot of students that probably would have been ample substitutes for that alternative fantasy. But anyway, Publisher Parish is just the story of a professor who decides to murder a student, and well, crazy shit happens. I mean, it is a dark comedy, and if there's one thing I can appreciate about dark comedies, in addition to their experimentation with crazy ideas, they can be a window at exploring many hierarchies and many institutional factors that we never really take the time to self-reflect on. And given the fact that it's tackling something as introspective as academia and how that itself is being held up on a certain lens nowadays, it does give you a lot of room to think and reflect on the role that academia plays in our culture nowadays and how important it is to take into account as to how we educate ourselves or how we choose to look at things that we never really reflected on in the past. I realize I'm being over analytical because at the end of the day, I just enjoyed my conversation with David. We talked about a lot of things like Star Wars, the movies that influenced his career as a filmmaker, the films he's worked on prior to Publisher Parish, and how proud he was of the film and the work he hopes to accomplish, because based on the premise alone, it sounds very interesting and just overall funny, because I think dark comedies are a rare treasure, and they're the reason that you can still watch a comedy and not feel that there's constraints to them. Anyway, I've babbled on enough in this intro. Hope you all enjoy this episode of Open Door Films. Check out the sponsors. Check out David's profiles. Go see Publish and Perish. Check out the trailer. And enjoy the show. Okay, well, David, thank you very much for giving me the time of your day to do this interview. And I wanted to say congratulations on your film. I saw the trailer for it. It looked very interesting. And aside from wanting to know more about it, I do want to know more about you as a filmmaker and your background. So just talk away.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you for having me here. I appreciate it. Yeah, I'm really excited about the movie and its release. You know, so me as a filmmaker, well, I've been making films for quite some time now. I've always wanted to be a filmmaker since I was a little kid. I made animated movies and just kind of have been a cinephile my whole life. You know, I went to school in Brooklyn College, where I got my MFA in production there. And so I've been making movies since. Also, I am also a professor of film. So I both teach it as well as make movies. And so part of, I feel very fortunate in that situation where I can both, you know, have a career that doesn't rely on the filmmaking by itself. But, you know, part of my responsibilities as a professor is to, you know, write books or make films or do something. So I have chosen to make movies this whole time. And so, yeah, that's kind of how I became a filmmaker, just kind of being involved.
Did you always have the, best way of putting this question is, when did this love for film spark in you?
You know, my parents were very supportive of the arts. My mother was an artist and my dad was a mathematician. And so they brought me to a lot of movies and theater and storytelling. And, you know, it was very open in my house as far as, you know, the arts. We loved the arts. And I do remember, like, I was a kid and I went to a summer camp, and there was another kid a little older than me who had done an animated film to Stevie Wonder's Superstition. So the story is, this guy comes down the stairs and the music is playing and all the furniture is dancing to the music. And I was just so impressed that this kid did this that I wanted to know how it was done. So I went at home and I looked into it and borrowed my dad's Super 8 camera. I had a single frame feature. So I kind of just experimented with it. And that was where I started with it. And then Star Wars came out not too much later than that. And I was hooked.
The Star Wars bug. That's more more common story than people realize. But in addition to that, was what did that introduce you to? And did watching Star Wars make you gravitate towards all other forms of cinema, or did you just like stick to sci-fi for a good period of time?
I mean, I've been a sci-fi fan way before Star Wars. I mean, I used to, that's the kind of fiction I typically am drawn to. But what drew me into making movies was, yeah, I was enthralled by the movie as everyone else on the planet. But I saw a making of, you know, like behind the scenes. And I do remember, like, the guys that were doing the post audio sound design, there was a scene where, like, they were in the desert and there was these high tension wires. And this guy had a mallet and he was hitting the mallet, the wire, this metal wire. And it went, phew, it made the noise that they used as the blasters. And so that kind of just opened my eyes as to how much of this is manufactured. And that alone was something that I had no idea that what that was happening. You know, I was a kid, right? But at the same point, I had no idea of the creative forces behind every element. And I wanted to know about that. And that was sort of one of the, you know, the first eye-opening experiences.
Have you ever wanted to make a science fiction film?
I haven't. I have, actually. My previous feature film is called A Feral World. And it is a post-apocalyptic science fiction film about a boy who is lost in the apocalypse, and he comes across a woman who is seeking out her daughter. The world has been destroyed by these nanobots. And so that was my first feature film, actually. And actually, when I was in grad school, I made my thesis film was a film called Hardwired. You know, it was very much a student project. You know, you can't find it anywhere intentionally, but it was my answer to Neuromancer, you know, the William Gibson novel.
Your answer to Neuromancer? What do you mean by that, the answer to it?
Well, it wasn't an answer to it. I mean, I was very inspired by Neuromancer. Uh-huh. The whole cyberpunk genre was brand new at the time, or it was new to me. And so I was very, very inspired by that. And so I made a film about a guy who, like, jacks into this cyberspace world and does stuff.
You know? I guess I was asking that is because when you read any work by William Gibson, you're definitely going to be totally lost. It requires a great deal of concentration just to get an idea of what the plot is about or where it's going. And I've heard even many theories about the book Neuromancer, and just that there are even hidden clues within just not only the story, but even certain pages within the book that when you made that statement that it was your answer to Neuromancer, you were just like introducing your own theory.
I mean, the book is pretty straightforward. It's not like unclear what the story is about. It is literally pretty simple about a guy who, you know, moves data, you know, and so it's the story of that, and he comes in contact with bad guys. So it's really, you know, it's just written in a very prose. The prose is very kind of complicated to kind of wrap your head around, but the more you read it, the more it becomes evident on what's going on. It's not, you know, unclear of what the story is. It was really, when I say my answer to it, I should have just said inspired by.
Yeah, but then when you think about William Gibson, I'm sure he was not a normal person, and that just like Philip K. Dick, that they had some abnormalities. Maybe they had their own beliefs. They were a little different from the conventional writer, that you'd think they probably inserted clues in their works. Nothing bordering on conspiracy theory, but just something to entertain yourself intellectually. And I assume that's what you meant when you said it was your answer to Neuromancer, but. Aside from that, tell me more about Publish and Perish, because I was rather fascinated by the idea and how it revolves around the subject of academia. And that's a topic I think is coming up more and more today.
Yeah, sure. So the story is about a professor who accidentally kills one of his students on the day that he's to deliver his tenure materials. And it's a dark comedy. And so he has to decide, does he do the right thing and take care of the kid, or does he firsthand, you know, deliver his dossier? Now, he's been working on this dossier for 7 years. And so this, you know, he has to make this decision, and it being a dark comedy, he makes some really bad decisions, and things start to kind of spiral out of control. That's kind of where the comedy goes. And I myself am a professor. And so, like, having gone through tenure, a lot of these ideas kind of came to my mind, like, well, what would happen? You know, like, what ifs? Because, you know, it is a very stressful thing. If you don't get tenure, you basically lose your job. So for me, it was, playing out these absurd scenarios and, what would happen if. And so that's kind of where the idea came from and what the story is.
Well, I'm sure plenty of professors have entertained the idea of a student they dislike and what to do with them.
Yeah, there are students we dislike, but they don't deserve to die.
No, I'm not going that far, but I'm saying I'm sure that there have been students that have pissed off certain professors.
Oh, yeah, all the time, every semester. Yes.
I mean, I did read the interview you did in promoting Publisher Perish, and I was rather fascinated by how you actually complimented the film Going Under the Silver Lake, because I feel that's a film that still has not garnered the respect it deserves, but it's very unique. Yet as comical as it is, it has some terrifying implications.
I really love that movie. I mean, I think I agree with you. I don't think it gets the recognition it deserves. It's not your general audience's kind of mass consumption, because it does require you to kind of ponder things that are going on, and you have to, as the viewer, have to piece things together. So I really like those kind of movies. I find those very engaging. I think it's funny and oddball. In fact, the design of our movie, as far as the cinematography, we looked at a lot of the imagery from that movie, as far as like, because we wanted it to be a noir-esque kind of vibe, yet we were really, you know, honing in on the comedy of it. I don't think Under the Silver Lake is very funny, but there are certainly funny, clever moments. But the vibe of that movie is similar to what I was sort of feeling when I wrote that.
When you're saying it's not funny, are you trying to assume it borders more in an absurdist territory? Because when you look at the protagonist of that film, he's just kind of wandering around through a culmination of events that he doesn't.
He's seeking that woman that he's attracted to. Like, he meets this girl and he thinks he has a connection with her, and then she's gone. And so, like, that's sort of the inciting incident of that story. He's trying to hunt her down, and not to hurt her, but to find out what happened to her. He thought, like, this could be, you know, a romantic involvement, and then she's gone. And so that leads him down this path that uncovers all these things. So it is a very fun movie.
Yeah, but the noir does that in many ways. Even the more classically dark noir has tackled the story of a protagonist being tied up in a plot that isn't really fully revealed to the audience. You don't truly understand it by the end, because it's beyond even the comprehension of the protagonist. But that itself just feels like a perfect metaphor for life in many ways. But I guess it's just rare, because films like yours and Under the Silver Lake I mean, it's rare to see a noir comedy when you think about it, given noir's tendency to towards a more thriller-like aspect.
I mean, that's why I'm also drawn to the Coen brothers movies, because I think they kind of are close. Like if you look at movies, you know, like Fargo or Big Lebowski, you know, those movies are funny. And Big Lebowski is a homage to the noir story and the private Dick, you know, trying to like solve the case, you know. So, but it's done in this, you know, backwards sort of way, you know. But I do like their movies, and I did read a lot of their screenplays before I started, you know, writing my screenplay.
Did you know there's actually a philosophy book centering around the works of the Coen brothers?
I did not.
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of film books that are titled like that, The Philosophy of True Detective, The Philosophy of The Wire, The Philosophy of the Coen Brothers, The Philosophy of Martin Scorsese. And I just didn't know, since you're a fan of the Coen Brothers, if you'd ever heard of that book. It's just basically called The Philosophy of the Coen Brothers, and it has a collection of philosophical essays written by multiple authors, culminated into this anthology.
I'll have to look for that. I mean, I did read almost all their screenplays. You know, when I was writing that, I really liked the tone of the movies. And if you know anything about screenwriting, it's like one of those things that people talk about is, how does one write tone? You know, because is it in the words or is it in the performance? And I don't really know the answer to that, but I was trying to see like, what is it that they do on the page? And then how do the performers interpret that in their own ways? So, you know, that was where I was going, but I wasn't familiar with that book, but I will look for it.
Since you just brought up screenwriting, what are your thoughts on screenwriting overall and how it's become its own industry? Because I've always been skeptical about screenwriting gurus in some sense, and some are better than others, clearly, but I want your thoughts on that, because there are a lot of books that are commonly mentioned in screenwriting as references.
Yeah, I mean, I've taught screenwriting at CU Denver, and what are my thoughts on screenwriting? I mean, it's an endeavor that you have to just dig yourself in. You know, everyone's process is different. You know, some people like to outline the whole movie before they start writing it. Other people like to sit down and, you know, let the story kind of develop as you go. And I think I'm the latter. I don't really find outlining fun, you know, so I don't do it that way. I see why it would be valuable, and I understand that. But, you know, there are several books that I think it's important to understand, like, you know, the three-act structure and how to format a screenplay. All that stuff is like, you know, the mechanics of what the screenplay looks like, and how it should have like an inciting incident. And, you know, like you can get that from Joseph Conrad's book, and, you know, all that stuff is there. Joseph Campbell. Thank you. Sorry. You know, the one book that I tend to revisit all the time, actually, like I have a few of them and they all kind of don't really do much for me. But this one is more for like the intermediate screenwriter. If you've written a screenplay, then this book called Your Screenplay Sucks, 100 Ways to Improve Your Screenplay. And what I really like about this book is that it's assuming that you've got a screenplay and what you can do to improve it. And as you know, like writing is rewriting. You know, I think, you know, you're constantly. Yeah. And so you're constantly tweaking and updating and changing and trying to improve it and see what works. And you have readings and hear what, you know, so all that stuff kind of works together. But I mean, it's an art form like any other thing. And I do agree with you, though. I do think that there's like a whole industry of people that are kind of trying to take advantage of the desire for people to be a filmmaker, to be a screenwriter, as if they're going to write the screenplay and then they'll be discovered. And, you know, I'm sure it happens, right? But it's a lottery. It's unlikely, you know? So it really is it's a combination of having the good screenplay and also having the right network and getting in the right room and knowing how to pitch and knowing, you know, so I'm sure there's a ton of great screenplays out there that no one will ever see because they don't know how to get past their table, you know, where they're writing it.
I think it has a lot to do with the fact that we live in an attention-based economy where I was talking with someone the other day and they told me that in 2009, a survey showed that what most people wanted to do with their lives post-graduation of high school or college was they wanted to become famous. And that all centers on the attention economy aspect. But I guess I'm asking this question about screenwriting more about rather the screenwriting gurus or books that have kind of simplified the process of screenwriting to a way where it kind of discredits it. I mean, there are some books that I find simplified so much that it is not a very healthy thing for a writer, as though that there is a specific way of how to write rather than multiple ways.
Agreed. I think you're right there. I mean, everyone's process is different, you know, and the truth of it is, like, if you're going in it to be famous, you're doing it for the wrong reason. Like, when I am writing, I am enjoying the process. I enjoy trying to see what's going to happen next and how do I complicate things? How do I give them, you know, I'm not thinking about my audience on the original pass. If I did, I would never get anything done, you know? So I can't let that kind of, you know, keep me away from, you know, my process and the character's goals. So yeah, I think you're right there. I don't think that there is a simple way to do it. It's just you know, like acting, not everybody is a good actor. Even if they want to be a good actor, you could probably be trained to become a good actor, but there are people who are innately talented and then there's people that are not, you know, so that's just the sad truth.
What do you necessarily mean by trained by an actor? Because I've never acted, but I've always been fascinated by the idea of how people perceive acting. And this reminds me of an interview Marlon Brando did I think it was the Dick Cavett Show, very old interview. And he says that, "I don't believe our species would be able to survive if we didn't know how to act." And he's regarding it in the big, more abstract sense that we're all playing a role outside of our personal lives, outside of the world going on inside our heads, that in many ways, I think of acting more as being, I guess that's the best way of putting it. You have to have
I have no, you know, I'm not a master of, you know, that kind of thing. I am not an actor. I don't have a desire to be an actor, but I understand actors. You know, I've taken classes, so I know what it feels like to be an actor. And really acting, when you are working with somebody who is a gifted actor, somebody who is well-trained, you see it, right? They don't own their every performance, right? They are willing to be like, okay, do you like that one? Let's try something different. You know, they understand the process of making movies and they don't necessarily feel like I gave you one version and that's all you're going to get because that's all I'm capable of. A really good actor is just, they're going to give you options. They're going to work with you. They take an adjustment. They say, thank you for the adjustment. They absorb it. And then they go forward and they bring that to the set. You know, and then it also comes down to casting, you know, like to cast the right people that are in the ballpark is a great advantage to somebody that you have to like figure out, how am I going to get this person to do a thing that I need them to do? And that's not the kind of person that, you know, so you really want to cast somebody that's sort of in the ballpark. You know, Spike Lee, you know, is famous for saying, you know, you cast the person who is already the person. So when it comes down to directing them, it's minor adjustments and, you know, to maybe emotional levels of where they are and how they're delivering something. But truthfully, I am in awe of actors. Like my lead actor, Timothy McCracken, I've learned so much about directing by working with him because he's so well-trained and gifted and understands the process. And so like we had a very rich relationship, you know, he would dig into the screenplay, come back with these questions and, you know, and I would see his performance being changed by these things. Because if you're working with someone who doesn't have that sort of experience, you can tell them their socioeconomic background and all this stuff, but you don't see it in the performances. But when you work with somebody who is able to do that, it's really quite amazing and truth and awe inspiring.
And with regards to Publish and Perish, when you were writing the screenplay for it, obviously you just said that you don't really take the, I mean, obviously you say that you don't write for the audience, but has there ever come a time when you're writing any script, especially this one, which clearly you do care about, that where the audience came into the equation, that it affected your writing process, like at some point, because you also want to respect your audience.
But that comes in later drafts, right? The first few drafts, you know, you just write you know, like, okay, I'm crossing a line here. I don't know if I can get away with this, but I think it's funny. Right now, while I'm writing this, I'm enjoying it and I want this here. And you live with it for a while, right? And then you're like, you know what? I don't know. I don't think the audience is going to be with me if I go down this route. So I definitely will let that enter into the process, you know, a few drafts in.
And may I ask, are there any other, did you think of any particular films while writing Publisher Paris besides Going Under the Silver Lake that might have influenced the way you wrote the screenplay or later drafts?
I was looking at Burn After Reading. I also looked at Fargo. You know, those, you know, it was really the tone, right? And it wasn't so much their storytelling and their stories. They are very different from my story. But, you know, what is it about those movies that make me laugh? Also, Inside Llewyn Davis is another one that I really love. And those movies, like, have things about it that make me laugh. I don't typically laugh out loud at most comedies. I am drawn to the dark comedy. I laugh at those kind of things. And so I wanted to make a movie that I would want to see, right? So therefore, I looked at those movies that I mentioned, including Under Silver Lake, and said, wow, I wish, you know, I could make a movie like that. You know, like, what would I have to do? And so that was where I was when I sat down to write the screenplay.
It's interesting that you've brought up the Coen brothers this many times, because I actually think of Inside, as much as I love No Country for Old Men or Blood Simple,
yeah,
I think Inside Llewyn Davis is probably one of their most underrated and underappreciated films.
Oh, it's a brilliant movie. I love it. Yeah.
Brilliant. But calling it a comedy, that's hard for me, because I do find plenty of moments of it funny. But I guess with the fact that we're both artists in a sense, because I write myself, there's something very tragic, because you can tell this, he's very, the character Oscar Isaac plays rather beautifully, is very talented. But the world is constantly taking a shit on him, and in a way where there is no real causal relationship. It's just one culmination of bad events after another.
Yes, which is not dissimilar, now that you mention it, to Publish or Perish. You know, I think Inside Llewyn Davis is funny, but you're right. Overall, it's not. It's a kind of a sad story, right? But there are some real laugh out loud moments in there. Like John Goodman's character, I think, is very funny. I think his relationship with, what's the lead, the actress who plays the girl that he gets pregnant, who hates him.
Carrie Mulligan.
Carrie Mulligan. She is very, their relationship is funny. Like, her distaste for him just made me laugh out loud. At the same point, my heart bleeds for her because she's in a strange situation. You know, so it's those kind of like dichotomies that I think are very interesting.
Maybe it was just her getting payback for the shit relationship they had in Drive. I mean, that's where they first cast together. And that, you could tell that even though it is Nicholas Winding Refn and nothing is really on the surface, it's all under the surface with his aesthetic, that they didn't have a good relationship. The characters, I mean.
Yes, yes, maybe.
I mean, to me, that's that. When I think about Drive, I hope I'm not diverting from the conversation, but I think that is a great film that probably will be remembered more over time.
I do enjoy that movie as well. That was a movie that I've revisited a few times. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've even read the book, which was radically different, but still very interesting. But yeah, going back to the Coen brothers, on a personal note, what is it you think makes people attracted, audiences attracted to their work, despite the fact that it's not really trying to be funny? Because even a film as dark and even as nihilistic as No Country for Old Men, it does have its own funny moments in some cases.
Yeah, I mean, that one's probably their least funny movie. But what's so engaging about that movie, though, is how grounded it is. You know, like, their mastery is in their performances, their storytelling abilities. You know, just like that whole sequence at the beginning with Josh Brolin looking through the binoculars and like there's almost no dialogue at that beginning part there. Yet we're captivated the whole time because we're watching him learn and explore and figure out what's going on along with him. And so that's a really great technique as far as getting your audience engaged. And that's the kind of thing that I really love, is like, if you can keep me in the story without dialogue, I just think that is, you know, something special is going on there. And they do that in Blood Simple, right, from their debut film as well. A lot of that storytelling is being told without dialogue as well.
No, I honestly think that's even a lesser funny film than No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, because, it's not funny. Yeah.
I mean, when you think about it, No Country for Old Men, and although you never associate Tommy Lee Jones, hard-assed and kind of a stereotype of seriousness he's become, you could see some humor in it that it's almost a parody in some ways.
Maybe like in his he's retiring and his reflecting where it is, it's more ironic than I would say funny, you know, like his situation, his place in the world, you know, and how his wife perceives him and how he is perceived and his awareness of himself is all very, you know, complimentary to him as an actor as well as the writing.
Yeah, and I guess this is just my own personal bias, because the first time I ever saw Tommy Lee Jones in anything was in Men in Black. And when you look at his performance in the first Men in Black film, you assume he's this hyper serious character in a very goofy, absurd world that is not that ultra serious, even though technically Men in Black is tackling serious themes. I mean, it is a 90s film, so many ways, I don't think it could ever go to that much darker aesthetic that films have kind of adopted post the 2000s.
Yeah, yeah. He was also a pretty good director. Like, there's a movie that he made, and I'm going to destroy the title, but it was something like
Lollapalooza. Is that it?
No, it was the two burials of it's a Spanish man's name. It's got anyway. It's actually very good, very dark. But and also not funny, but it was really good. I could look it up if you want me to here.
Oh, absolutely. And I realized, I just think I might have messed up. I think it was Ed Harris that directed that film. I'm not, because I think Ed Harris is in, I got him confused. No, so I feel like an idiot.
I'm looking him up now. Let's see.
But even that film's pretty old.
Yes. It was the, let's see here. As a director, he's directed I don't want to keep you waiting here, I guess.
Don't worry about it.
Okay. Let me see here. It's called, let me look it up by his name then. Oh well, I don't know. I'll find it and then we can keep chatting though. Yeah.
Oh, don't worry. I won't even edit this part of the interview. It makes it more natural.
Oh boy.
I told you it was unscripted. You could say whatever you want as long as not. I mean, I won't edit it.
Okay. All right.
Which reminds me, I did want to ask you, why the Batman thing upside down behind your chair? Why upside down? That intentional?
No, it is unintentional. This is my family know I'm a movie geek, and so it's got a cape on it. So it's a thing that you put on the back of your chair. I didn't even notice it was upside down until you mentioned it.
I thought it was intentional because this might be a weird thing to introduce, but I'm certain that you're a fan of Christopher Nolan's work, and his first film following. His first independent film actually had a Batman logo on one of the apartments they used for filming. It had literally had it attached to the door, like a sticker. So,
oh, really? No, I did not know that.
And this was like a film he made in 1997, 8 years before he even tackled the subject of Batman.
Interesting.
Huh. I doubt he knew he would one day direct a Batman film.
Yeah, probably not. But that's definitely one of my favorite of his movies.
Which one?
The Dark Knight.
Ah, yeah. Interesting. Well, interesting, because I'm also amazed by how much some people always debate between the first, second, and the third, because there are just some people that debate whether they like the third or the second one even more, and that's just an interesting conversation for another day. I mean, I would definitely like to have a discussion with someone which one's better.
I mean, oh, here it is. It's called The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. He directed that. Yeah. Okay.
What year did he direct that?
He directed this in 2005, or it came out in 2005.
And is it a Western?
It is.
That seems like a sub question. I think if you could depend on someone to direct a Western nowadays, I think Tommy Lee Jones would definitely be in that list of people.
For sure. For sure.
Given his roots, and he just has the look of a cowboy in many ways.
Yeah, he's got a great face, doesn't he? He's got that, you know, those lines in his face, like him and Sam Elliott, you know, they're made to be in Westerns.
Yeah, but when it comes to Sam Elliott, he just doesn't look like he's aged at all. Even when you look at his character in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, well, that one now is what, we're like 25 years into that now. But if you look at him in, you know, he was in that show 1883, and he's definitely aging, but like he ages well. He still has got quite a presence.
Are you a fan of the Yellowstone series?
You know, honestly, I've never seen the Yellowstone series at all. I've only seen the 1883, and I thought that was terrific. You know, that lead actress, she just had everybody in that. It blew me away. It was a very good show.
I've only seen 1923 with Harrison Ford, and it was really interesting. I actually thought it would be a limited series because, but then again, I guess Taylor Sheridan is trying to create a whole universe of these series because he's got one. He's got the 1883 one. I'm sure he was behind that one. He's got 1923, and then he also is currently working Yellowstone. And I'm not sure. I haven't seen that yet, and I've heard that Kevin Costner might be leaving for some reason.
I can tell you, though, that one of our actors in our movie, Publisher Parrish, she has a role in 1923. She's a day player in ours, but she's terrific. She's got a very she was in two scenes, actually. Her name is Amy McKenzie, and she's in that movie, in that show.
That name does sound familiar, and I think I saw it in the opening credits of the show.
Yeah,
I was watching it. It's been quite a while because I finished it in March, right around the time it ended in late February, because it was split. The first four episodes were broadcasted, and then they took a weird break, which was odd, and then they released the last four episodes of a season. So they're clearly going to renew it for a second season.
Yeah.
Man, that brings me on to another question. Since you said you did make a sci-fi, have you ever thought of a Western? Has that ever come to your mind? Because I know the Western is somewhat making a comeback, but mostly through television rather than film.
I mean, I am a big fan of Westerns when done right, you know, but I don't know if that's my genre. You know, I grew up in New York, and I'm not a cowboy at all. I live in Colorado now, but, you know, I don't know that culture well enough to dig in. And, you know, I mean, I love watching those things when they're done well, though. Can you get the dog? Thank you.
What kind of dog was it?
He's a Whippet.
A Whippet?
Yes. It's like a small greyhound, smaller greyhound.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, going back to the idea of the Western, the reason I ask is because I've lately noticed that the Western is kind of surging back, just like the horror film has made somewhat of a comeback, because I mean, nobody really cares for the horror film that does jump scares anymore. Just the many of the stereotypical knobs that have just kind of tired out, and I just wanted your idea on the Western.
I mean, I love some, like, you know, Unforgiven is terrific, and I also love the remake of 310 to Yuma with Russell Crowe. I mean, that to me is a terrific movie. And actually, one of my actors, and he's a day player in Publisher Parrish, has a small role in 310 to Yuma. I didn't know that until after we cast him and I saw him, so that was kind of a little geekdom that I enjoyed. So, yeah.
Since Publisher Parrish focuses on the idea of a teacher trying to get tenure, do you think it gives you a better insight of how you feel about academia overall? Because I feel that academia
definitely poke fun at it, for sure.
Poke fun at the idea of academia?
I would say not the idea of academia. Like, I respect all kinds of education, and I think there's great value there. I really do. It's the personalities, it's the structure, it's the hierarchies of academia that, like any big corporation, I don't think it's dissimilar. You know, that's why I think that there's a good crossover between people that work in a corporate environment or academia. Like, there are people in charge, and then there's the people that are, you know, boots on the ground working with the students, you know? And so there is a very, you know, we all do what we can to give the students their education and the best experience possible. But there's a lot of tough personalities, and there's a lot of interpersonal conflicts that, you know, are unpleasant, silly, unnecessary. And that's kind of what I'm poking fun at in my movie.
But not as a way of you taking one side over the other so much as just presenting it.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, because my lead character, who I love, he's not a likable guy, right? But the guy that is the antagonist is his boss, the dean, who does nothing wrong per se, but he's an asshole, you know, like, so like that he has to. So, you know, that was something that my son had pointed out to me. He's 13. He was like, why do we like the guy who's doing all these terrible things, but we don't like the guy who really hasn't done anything wrong? And that's, I took pride in that when I heard that, because that was my goal, was to have you empathize with this guy, despite the fact that, you know, he's making these terrible decisions.
But then I think it has to do more of just the circumstances, because when you look at based on what you're telling me about this story, the circumstances have kind of put him in that position. And because they're much bigger than him, do you think it gives people room to just reflect on how his choices are just merely a reaction?
Oh, 100%. Like, that was things that Tim and I, are my lead, we talked about. Like, he's doing these terrible things, but every single thing he does makes sense to him, right? Like, there's a reason why he's doing it. It's all for the betterment of his career, which is betterment for his family, which, you know, so, it, you know, it all makes sense. And we see that as a viewer, why he's doing it, but it doesn't make it any less ugly.
Yeah, it's kind of similar to Breaking Bad in many ways. Because
yes, that's a great reference point. Thank you.
I remember once watching a video of Vince Gilligan saying that the audience doesn't necessarily have to agree with the actions or choices Walter makes, but I want them to understand where he's coming from.
Yes.
In addition to just the family angle, I think the more empathetic aspect of Breaking Bad that explores the psychology of Walter White, or just the decisions he makes, I think the bigger picture is just the environment he's in that makes his choices understandable. Because when you think about it, he's an overqualified high school professor working in an economy that doesn't have much room for good educational jobs, or I guess you could say, especially in an environment where more jobs are being eliminated, and just the idea of an infrastructure that is highly disorganized leaves little breathing room for people who are highly qualified, that it definitely creates that kind of frustration, because you kind of see that in the beginning of the show. And one question that I've debated with friends of mine who are fans of the show as well is, even though you could say that Walter in the beginning was a good person, he was not better than he was when he became Heisenberg, because he was complacently good out of conformity rather than any authenticity.
Yeah, maybe his true self came out. Yeah. And I really appreciate that you mentioned Breaking Bad, because I am very inspired by that show. I love that show. In fact, I've got Vince Gilligan here that he sits on my desk. This is
a new Vince Gilligan Funko, because I think there was another one as well. He's not one.
I got this one a few years ago. I don't know. I mean, he sits on my desk when I write, and I like to believe that I get some inspiration from him. Oh, but
Oh, well, I'm hoping they one day create a Chris Nolan Funko. That would be interesting.
Yeah, I also have a J.J. Abrams one as well sitting. Like, I like the director ones. There's one for Jordan Peele also I like. So
I thought of once getting the Guillermo del Toro one, because I'm a big fan of his work. It's been a while since I've seen any of his recent stuff, since The Shape of Water.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything since that either. Someone was talking to me about Pinocchio, and I'm now kind of curious, because what I heard was not what I was expecting. And so I kind of want to take a look at that, because I also admire his work a lot.
Well, when you watch the original Pinocchio, you start seeing things you didn't see as a child when you first saw it. Because when you watch that movie and just look at the way the world sees a lot of the topics in that film today, it's much darker than you realize. I mean, this may be a little off topic. I mean, I don't know if you're a fan of Joe Rogan, but I was actually a few months ago, I saw an episode where he and a guest actually brought up that movie, and they played one of the darker scenes of that movie. And when you watch it now, it's rather terrifying of what the implications were, especially with one of the more evil characters in the film, especially when, I don't know if you remember Pleasure Island, but there is something twisted about that.
Yeah. I don't really remember it, but I have to take a look at that. Yeah.
I mean, that was just old school Disney in my eyes, because Disney has radically changed so much that it just produces somewhat of the same material from time to time.
Yeah. I'm not a Disney. I don't typically gravitate to Disney shows. Yeah, that's not where I go typically. Yeah. And I admire them. You know, I respect their, you know, what they do, but it's not the kind of films that I seek out.
And speaking of Breaking Bad, there, when were you thinking about it while you were creating Publish or Perish? Because in many ways, Breaking Bad, I don't know why I get the first impression when you look at Breaking Bad is you see somewhat of a dark comedy angle to it.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if I was conscious of it, but I was that guy that, like, you know, I couldn't wait for next week's episode to come. Like, I didn't watch it after it was released. I watched it as they were coming week by week. And I was hooked, and I was so into it and so invested in that show. So at some level, it's got to be, you know, running around my subconscious, but it wasn't something that I set out to do.
Well, have you seen Better Call Saul?
Yes, every episode. I love that show. Yeah.
So have you resolved the debate as to which one's better? Because it's difficult.
I don't really do that. I mean, I don't know which one. I enjoy them both in very different ways. You know, I think, you know, there's very little comedy to me in Better Call Saul, and the pacing is a little bit slower. Yet at the same point, it's wildly smart, like Breaking Bad is. You know, it's just a different show. So Bob Odenkirk is terrific, and so I really enjoy watching him and how he develops. Also, I really liked Rhea Seehorn. You know, I think she was a terrific character. I think that's her name.
Rhea Seehorn.
Yeah, who played Kim. You know, so I was hooked on that show as well, you know, and but it was a much slower paced pro show. So, you know, you hear people talk who are not like us, who can sit, you know, I don't measure something, whether it's going to be slow, fast, happy, sad. I'm sold by story and performances. So like I'll buy into anything if all those things are well done, you know, so.
No, I think in many ways, this is just my personal thought, is that Better Call Saul were slower because they had to work with a lot more characters, and they definitely wanted to add more complexity to not just the character of Saul Goodman. Because when you think about it, Saul Goodman in Breaking Bad, he was definitely much more comedic, and I would say, would you say two-dimensional, as opposed to what Better Call Saul did for him?
I say that's probably not incorrect. You know, we didn't get to know him very well, but you did see, you know, we didn't get to see him ever being nice, right? In Better Call Saul, we saw him, you know, as Jimmy before he became Saul, and he was a much kinder, thoughtful person. And you saw that shift, you know, so we don't see any of that in Better Call, in Breaking Bad.
Well, in Breaking Bad, he was really just emulating the role of Saul Goodman, the performance.
And he was just very, you know, he was just all about money and about himself. You know, it wasn't about anybody else. So in this one, you get him to see, you see that he loves Kim, right? And so we never saw him love anybody but himself in Breaking Bad.
I think, yeah, but I still feel that it was just in Breaking Bad. And when you see how he transitions into Saul Goodman in the show Better Call Saul, you see it's just like a way of a coping mechanism. Many ways to not deal with his own psychology or his own mental issues, because he's a very flawed and impulsive person.
Yeah. Yes. Agreed.
And yeah. Based on the trailer of Publisher Parrish, I see that character in many ways, based on the self-destructive actions he takes, as the kind of person that is impulsive naturally. Would you say that about your main character?
You know, I think he's only impulsive when he was put under the gun, you know, like he was very thoughtful and pragmatic about his process. And then that gets all thrown out the door. And so now what do you do? Right. So that's where we meet my character. Like, he's been very like, I'm a family man. I love my wife. I love my child. I'm providing a home. I'm doing all the right things. I'm a good teacher. And then this terrible thing happens. And so all that is being thrown away, and he's trying to remedy the situation. And so that's kind of where, like, it's all based on one incident that just, and how he handles that incident.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And are there any other projects that you're working on at the moment that you would like to explore to the same extent that you did with Publisher Parish? Because I think the subject of academia is fascinating because there are a lot of hierarchies and structures in academia that make it very difficult for people who just want to educate the next generation much more difficult.
For sure. I have another screenplay that it's in a good place. It's, you know, we're calling it done at this point, but we're open to rewrites based on notes and this, that. But it's not in academia, though. It's called Love Less Likely. It's also a dark comedy. The premise is basically about a woman who is cursed, and the men that she has sex with die horrible deaths. And so that's the premise of the story. And she befriends a boy, and they go on a journey together to try to find a remedy for this.
And I guess some final questions on Publisher Parish. What do you hope to ultimately have audiences take away from the film outside of just entertainment?
I mean, I wish I had, you know, there's this thing that I remember hearing, and correct me if you know, I think it was Samuel Goldman who said this. You know, he said, like, you know, if I wanted to send a message, I would have sent a telegram. You know, what I like about that is that he, you know, he owned the fact that this was entertainment. I mean, I think I don't have a goal for someone to walk away to learn something. It is about entertainment, and it is about enjoyment and engagement. But at the same point, it's because we connect with the characters, right? So for anything, it's that we understand the situation that this person would be put in. And if something like that happened to you, how would you respond to it? I think that's the question that I leave the audiences. You know, it does poke fun at academia, but that's really the world in which it lives. It isn't really about academia. It's really about, you know, having an adversarial relationship with a boss. It's being like, worry about your career and the decisions that we make, you know? So I wish I had a more grandiose, you know, meaning behind it, but it is really about keeping my audiences and trying to, you know, get you to care about them.
Very good. And well, David, could you tell me more about, can you tell where people can find and learn more about your work and just what's coming up next?
For sure. So I have a website. It's called tinyfistfilms.com. That's where you can learn about me and some of my past work. But we also have our Publish or Perish movie. I think the website is publishorperish.movie or publishorperishmovie.com, either one of those. So you can learn about the movie and the release. It's going to be on Amazon, Vudu, and some on-demand stations cable stations as of August 18th. So that's when it's going to be available to the public. And as far as the next project, you know, my partner and I, Jonathan, we have a few screenplays that we're considering, you know, possibly my screenplay, but we have other ones that we're looking at that we both like a great deal. Always a few things in the fire that I'm hoping to get off the ground.
Well, David, I do want to thank you for giving me the time of your day to do this interview. And again, thank you for letting me know where people can learn more about you, because I haven't seen Publisher Parish yet, obviously, since it hasn't been available, but I am looking forward to seeing it and getting an idea of just the topics that it was tackling. And it did look very fascinating just by the first impressions of the trailer. And again, thank you for the discussion. I liked talking with you about the movie and all the other things that have influenced your work. And I'm glad to know that Breaking Bad did come into the conversation to some extent, because not many people interpret that show as, in some sense, as a dark comedy in many ways.
Oh yeah. I mean, even I appreciate all of the things you said. Just one quick thing about that is that I always thought the relationship between Jesse and Walter was so comedic that it was almost like a modern day Abbott and Costello at times. You know, so yeah. But thank you for all the, you know, the conversation as well. I enjoy talking to you about movies and listening to your podcast and all that. So thank you for your time.
Oh yeah. And I would look forward to the next time we can have a discussion, because based on what you told me about your new project, it definitely sounds very interesting. And just the premise alone puts a lot of questions in my mind.
All right. Well, I'd love to chat more.
Well, David, again, thank you. And I wish you the best of luck with your career, your work in film, and
Are there any of your books? I mean, are there any books that you've published that I should take a look at?
I have not published any books other than a long time ago. I did, it was a tech book about some sound software, but I don't have any published books. Yeah. But I have a bunch of movies you can check out. A Feral World is out there if you want to watch my low budget feature that I did prior to Publish or Perish. It's out there and in the world, and you can see that.
But I take it there's no way I'll ever be able to access that student film of yours.
No, you can see the trailer for it on Vimeo or YouTube, but you'd have to twist my arm to let you see that. Maybe if we ever get together, I could show it to you privately. It is not going public.
Come on, don't deny me the ability to twist your arm. That might be entertaining. But yeah, definitely. I would definitely like to look at that and see. I would definitely like to watch it privately. That's for sure.
All righty.
Well, again, thank you, David. And again, good luck and best of it with Publisher Parish.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You have a nice day.
You too. Take care.
Take care.